Listen to RN Music shows on demand. abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. You're listening to Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/rn. So Einstein and Charlie Chaplin walk into a bar, and what happens next? Well, it's all to do with science and art. More on this later. But we start with China, which for many years has been the world's leading trading economy. Simultaneously, it's been rapidly modernising and growing its military. Defence spending as a share of GDP is rising, as are tensions between China and its neighbours in the South China Sea, Japan and Taiwan. The more muscular foreign policy posture under President Xi Jinping has heightened concerns about China's strategic intention. But we shouldn't worry, says China expert Dr. Jeff Raby. He's an Australian economist and businessman and was Australia's ambassador to China from 2007 to 2011, and Australia's chief trade negotiator. China is a very constrained superpower. At a talk at the University of Melbourne, Jeff Raby explains why this is so and what it means for our region.
My presentation tonight is China constrained superpower. I hope after this evening's presentation you can sleep a little easier about the rise of the dragon. And it is something of an antithesis to many of the discussions today about China and its rise and its military modernisation. When viewed from Canberra, Manila or Washington, the rise of China as an emergent power understandably can look threatening. Strategic analysts often project their historic readings into the present, and there's a very strong thesis around that I call the rising power equals conflict thesis, that somehow there's an assumption that the past will repeat itself in the present as China rises and seeks strategic space, and others, particularly the United States, will have to accommodate that strategic space. Obviously, there are a lot of analogies drawn between China's rise and the rise of Germany in the 20th century and on two occasions leading to war. And in fact, Margaret Macmillan's very fine book on the First World War really sets out to try and suggest that somehow we're seeing a replay of those circumstances in the 21st century. Certainly, in recent times, we've seen China starting to throw its weight around a bit, particularly in the South China Sea, in the islands dispute with Japan, and with, I think, what was quite a big surprise to everyone and quite a provocative action by China, the declaration of the unilateral declaration of an air identification zone. So this is taken very much by strategic analysts and particularly also the popular media, that this is all evidence in support of the rising power equals conflict thesis. And you can't, of course, rule out that as a possibility. We really don't know where this might end, but there are ways of looking at it that I think can be somewhat more reassuring than the conflict thesis. On the other hand, certainly it's not wise to base strategic policy on assertions or assumptions or beliefs about China's intentions. It was surprising to me in Henry Kissinger's otherwise very, very fine book called On China, that towards the end, maybe he's getting tired and wanting to finish the book, he asserts that China is not an expansionary power. Well, I don't know how you can assert that. We don't know, and we don't know in the future what China's behaviour might be like, but we certainly know that Qing Dynasty China was very expansionary. Qing expanded into Mongolia, into Xinjiang, the western provinces of China. In fact, Xinjiang simply means new frontier. As far as Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, this was all part of the Qing territories. Now, you could argue against that. Well, the Qing weren't really Chinese because the Qing were Manchus, and the Manchus are essentially Mongolians. And of course, you know, looking at the days of Genghis Khan and so on, it's pretty boring in Mongolia. So after you've sat in your yurt for a few months over winter drinking vodka and telling jokes, there's nothing left to do but to go out and rape and pillage and jolly yourself along. So it sort of is innate for the Manchus to do those sorts of things. But the Ming dynasty, which was purely Han, of course, wasn't expansionary, and it stayed within very small borders much smaller than China today. But we don't really know. And I often point out to people that democratic Taiwan, which is always seen as a sort of counterpoint to communist authoritarian China, the KMT and the Democratic People's Party all claim territory far in excess today than what the Communist Party in Beijing claims. So, for example, if the KMT ever came back to power, then they would be claiming the whole of Mongolia, for example, and great swathes of Kazakhstan, because for the KMT, the borders are the old Qing borders. So it doesn't go to whether it's communist or not communist, democratic or not democratic. And we have no certainty, no reason to believe that China is inherently non-expansionary, as Henry Kissinger asserted. But it's not necessary to fall back to those positions. What I would ask you to do, and what I'm going to do now for the rest of my presentation, is try and look at the world in geopolitical strategic terms, in security terms, from Beijing. Not from Canberra or Washington or Manila, but how the world looks from Beijing. And what you see is enormous growth in economic weight and might, and increasingly huge growth in military power in terms of hardware and equipment. Whether China would have the software and the systems to manage a major conflict is arguable at this stage. But it certainly has been spending on military modernization more than it has been growing in GDP terms. And so military expenditure is rising as a share of China's total GDP. So it does look like there is a growing issue to a problem, a big country, big militarization, rapid growth, and that must point to some destabilization. But what I'd suggest is that China's capacity to act, to exert force, to project military power is heavily constrained by its history, by its geography, and by its resources. And I'll go through some of the constraints on China and why I think China is a constrained superpower. First of all, China is still an empire. It still has within its borders significant unresolved territorial issues. Xinjiang, Tibet, Taiwan, and what is perhaps surprising, possibly now even Hong Kong. Now, these issues occupy the lion's share of security thinking and considerations and cause the greatest worry, if you like, to the leadership in Beijing. And not surprisingly, they attract the lion's share of the resources that are devoted to security. So China is still trapped and constrained by its history. And then its geography. China has 14 countries on its borders with 22,000 kilometres of land borders to defend, and nearly with each one of those countries on its borders, China at different times has been in conflict. It fought a war against Vietnam, which it instigated in 1979 and was defeated. There's been ongoing military skirmishes with India, but the big one, of course, is Russia. And don't be misled by the happy snaps of Putin and Xi Jinping together at different international meetings. Behind that is deep mutual suspicion and fear. The Russians fear a billion plus people who seem to consume resources like there's no tomorrow, looking over the border at vast underpopulated areas in Siberia, rich with resources. And China recognises that Russia, historically and even today, as we've seen with the Crimea and Ukraine, seeks to achieve its security through occupying territory on its borders. And it has occupied large swathes of China in the past, parts of Xinjiang, northeast China, Manchuria, as it used to be called. China has a very deep suspicion of Russia, and it's reciprocated by Russia towards China. So this is another major security challenge for China. How to police 22,000 kilometres of border, how to manage 14 complex relationships with only one, the one with Pakistan, looking anything like a relationship based on trust. Then there's China's existential anxiety, which is the little brother in North Korea. China lives in fear of the collapse or implosion of the North Korean state, of the DPRK. China wants nothing more than the status quo to continue indefinitely, but they also know that it can't continue indefinitely with the policies and the behaviours of the regime. No one knows what the longevity of the DPRK will be, but you cannot, as a strategic planner, do your strategic planning based on the assumption that it's going to be around forever. And a collapse of the DPRK means two things. One, you would rapidly have a US ally, military ally, on China's borders, and possibly the US on China's borders. But secondly, there's something like a million troops under arms in the North Korean army. And in northeast China, there's a very big Korean ethnic Chinese population. And in fact, Shenyang, the capital of the Liaoning province, is very interesting. Most cities in the world have a Chinatown in the downtown area, right? If you want a Chinese meal, just go to downtown and you'll find a Chinese restaurant. Shenyang is one of the few cities in the world that doesn't have a Chinese restaurant in the downtown, but has a Korean town in the downtown area. So it's a very big Korean population through northeast China. And so from Beijing's perspective, this looks very, very threatening and very troubling, both in terms of the US, but also in terms of instability in northeast China. There's Japan, and there the historical issues are both unresolved and unresolvable. And the tensions will wax and wane. On both sides, Japan and China, use these issues for domestic purposes and beat up the nationalist drum. And this is an enduring and ongoing source of tension and problems, and from Beijing's point of view, again, a major strategic concern and source of anxiety. Then there's Southeast Asia, and this is where we've seen China behaving in somewhat, ways that are difficult to explain. China's broad strategic objective with Southeast Asia is basically to balance US power in that part of the world. It doesn't seek to remove the US from Southeast Asia because the US presence there actually serves China's interests. It helps manage the Japanese issue. It also helps on the Korean Peninsula. And certainly US presence prevents a nuclear arms race between China, Japan, and South Korea. So what China's trying to do is to balance, not remove US power from the region, but its behaviour in Southeast Asia, its assertiveness over the Spratly Islands and its actions have largely undermined many of the big gains that China made in its foreign policy up until 2007 or 8, when it started to adopt a more muscular approach to this issue. It's ultimately counterproductive for its interests. So as China tries to assert itself in that region, it actually encourages and drives those countries closer towards the United States and provides a basis for the United States to enhance its presence, therefore undermining China's longer-term objective of balancing US power. Some of you may have seen my piece in the Australian Financial Review on this subject. It is interesting that even if it wishes to project power into this part of the world, the consequence will be counterproductive to its longer-term strategic objectives. But the most important constraint on China is the fact that China has now become utterly dependent on world markets for all the resources, energy, and increasingly the food it needs for its own survival. Now, China historically has been a very rich country. It's got a fantastic natural resource base. Iron ore, for example, China still supplies over 40% of its iron ore requirements. It's got massive coal reserves. It's got the biggest coal reserves in the world. It's been able to feed huge populations for centuries. It is a very productive and a very well endowed resource country. There just happens to be a lot of them. And it was okay when there was a lot of them and they're really poor, but now a lot of them are becoming quite rich. And so the demand for resources has increased enormously. And so what we've seen is that from the mid-1990s, China has been through a series of tipping points where it's gone from being largely self-sufficient in a resource or an energy source to becoming a significant importer to becoming a major net importer and in many cases the biggest importer in the world. So take crude oil for one example. Up until 1995, China was largely self-sufficient in crude oil. It then started to see its imports rise, its net imports rise. By 2000, it was becoming a major importer. And then we had the accelerated growth surge throughout the 2000s. And China today is the world's single largest importer of crude oil. And you can trace that across nearly every commodity group. Iron ore, most of the metals. China has just become a huge vacuum cleaner, if you like, sucking up these resources from around the world for its own economic development. Interestingly enough, as an anecdote, I first went to China in May of 1985, gosh, a long time ago now when I think about it, and I was working in the Office of National Assessments at the time. And in the mid-1980s, the Japanese had started to build infrastructure in China, building, for example, the first electrified train line from Datong in Shaanxi province, about nearly 1,500 kilometres, I think, or maybe not quite, 1,000 kilometres from the coast. The first electrified line in all of China, in all of China's history, is built by the Japanese to ship coal to the port of Qinhuangdao. And the Japanese were building automatic coal loading terminals in Qinhuangdao. And in Australia, everyone was terrified that China was going to flood our regional markets with their coal. And we could see us losing the markets in Japan and South Korea and Taiwan and Hong Kong. And so I went up to try and understand what was going on. And I remember going to the port of Qinhuangdao. And, ONA is not an intelligence collection body. It's an analytical body. But I remember being briefed before leaving Canberra on how to guess what the depth of the port of Qinhuangdao was so we could try and work out how big the ships could be to come in and steal our markets. Little did we know that all that coal would end up in China's coal-fired power stations up and down its coast, and that China today is a very major importer of coal, both coking coal and steaming coal. So this was not how it was meant to be, by the way. The Deng Xiaoping reform and open door policies, which were instigated from the late 70s, were not intended to integrate China into the world economy on the basis of some sort of Ricardian principles of comparative advantage. It was intended to be pure mercantilism. You know, you export what you need to buy the technology, to attract the capital, in order to substitute inside your borders for all the imports that you're importing and to keep yourself pretty much closed off to the rest of the world. The Chinese mentality was, is, and only now is starting to change under the pressure of their own economic success. It was has largely been mercantilist. And so I envisage sometime around 2005 or 2006, around the middle of the last decade, someone in Zhongnanhai, the leadership compound in the middle of Beijing, waking up in the middle of the night screaming at the ceiling saying, "You know, Chairman Mao, what have we done? We have made ourselves utterly dependent on these foreigners. It's not in the plan." And that really is a product of unexpected success and the massive, massive growth that occurred in the throughout the 2000s. Compare this to the rise of the US after the Civil War. The United States, as it rose to world power and dominance, it had no unsettled issues inside its borders. It had no hostile borders. And within its borders, it had every single thing it needed for its economic growth way into the 20th century, other than people. And it sucked people out of Europe in huge numbers, which had, by the way, already been educated and trained at the expense of European taxpayers. So the conditions of the United States' rise to great power status vastly different, could not be any more different than those which faced China today. Now, there's a very big strategic implication behind all of this for China and its resource dependency. And that is, currently, China is utterly dependent on the Straits of Malacca. Nearly all of these resources that China needs go through the Straits of Malacca. It is the major strategic vulnerability that China faces. And the Chinese leadership and military planners know that they are 20, 30, maybe more years away before they could challenge the United States in that area. So they don't actually have a military option by which to achieve their security. Enter the new Silk Road policies. The One Belt, One Road, it's Chinese leadership gobbledygook, but you get the idea. That is trying to and intended to give China strategic options. And it's doing it by opening up transport routes for the first time directly into the Indian Ocean. So just this year, they've completed the twin pipelines from Kunming going through Burma to the coast of Burma, where there are terminals. So now, for the first time ever, Iranian crude oil can come straight to China across Burma through these pipelines without having to go through the Straits of Malacca. China's built a major port in its friendly neighbour, Pakistan, on the Indian Ocean. Many strategic people have worried that this is part of an attempt by China to project military power in the Indian Ocean. That could be an element in this. But what its main purpose is as a port to service Xinjiang and the western parts of China. And they have rebuilt the road up through Pakistan, up through the northern areas of Pakistan and into Xinjiang. And if you're in that part of Xinjiang, the truck traffic is just astronomical, going up and down. When I first went to Chongqing as ambassador, was in 2007, the mayor of Chongqing, Mayor Huang, who happens to still be there, which is remarkable, seeing he had to survive all the Bo Xilai stuff, must be a very skillful politician. He was explaining to me about how they're building a railway from Chongqing to Dortmund in Germany. And I knew where Chongqing was. I didn't know where Dortmund was. But Chongqing is like 2,000 kilometres from Shanghai. So all the goods from Chongqing, a major manufacturing centre with a population of about 30 million people, have to go down the Yangtze, then be transshipped onto bigger ships, and then go all the way to Europe or to Germany. That's a trip of about 38 days. And he was talking about doing it by train in 8 days. And I thought, yeah, okay. I hear this all the time. Well, the railway's been in operation for nearly 2 years. And it's so successful, every city, and this is another fact of the life of China, that sort of everyone wants to get in on the game, every city's getting a railway somewhere to Europe. There's one, I think, from Wuhan to Madrid. There's one from somewhere else through to Gdansk. This is another alternative to the Straits of Malacca. And now we've got major gas pipelines from Central Asia, soon from Russia. China will spend whatever it takes and whatever it needs to do to give itself strategic options. And that is a major way it is seeking its security in this world where it feels utterly dependent on the rest of the world. It's also trying to achieve its security, in addition to the Silk Road concept and so on, with building regional institutions. And we've just seen the launch of the Asia Infrastructure Bank. We can expect there's going to be many more of these initiatives by China. Already there's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. There's the BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa Bank. But really, this is going beyond anything they've done before to propose and now establish the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. It's unbelievable that Australia, or to my mind, or the Australian government, was so off balance over this, found it so difficult to get a position on this initiative. And unfortunately, we lost the early mover advantage. Had we gone in at the beginning, first major developed country to embrace this and join up, we could have named our price in terms of senior positions, organisation and so on. So we have to learn to live with a China that is constrained in its capacity to project force, which is a good thing. As I said, I hope you go home tonight and sleep a little easier after this. But a China which will understandably and inevitably look for ways to achieve and realise its security, particularly in its region. Number one, as I said, is to remove its strategic dependency, or mitigate it, to reduce it. It will never go entirely on the Straits of Malacca, but it will also engage in regional institution building. And these things will change the world in many ways. Just remember that when Vasco da Gama went around the Cape of Good Hope in 1470, 200 years later, the Silk Road, the old Silk Road, disappeared when we opened the Suez Canal. The change of trade routes brings with them major changes in geopolitical balance. And so this is the world we're living in now. It's a world of change and flux. I don't think it's a dangerous world. It's a world where there are lots of risks, but that's always been the case. But the regional geopolitical order is being remade as we sit here this evening. So for Australia, I think our best response in all of this is to recognise the inevitability and the reality of it, to be supportive of China's efforts to find security in the region, and in doing so, seek to influence the outcomes in ways which reflect our interests as well. Thank you very much.
China's strategic outlook and priorities, however, look quite different when viewed from Beijing than from Canberra or Washington. Dr. Jeff Raby is an Australian economist, diplomat and businessman with a long and distinguished career in foreign affairs. You're with Big Ideas on RN. Now to science and art colliding. Strange bedfellows? Maybe. There's a new union forming in London, Singapore and Melbourne. Dr. Daniel Glaser is a neuroscientist who has worked for many years promoting public engagement with science. In 2014, he was the first scientist to be a Man Booker judge. He is director of the Science Gallery London at King's College, a new space where scientists and artists collaborate. But it's not science examining art, nor art depicting science. The collaboration is creating something new.
The conjunction between art and science has long histories. It's clear that it dates at least to Leonardo da Vinci, whose anatomical investigations of the human form and of the possibilities of technology legendarily combined art and science. I did a little bit of research before I came. There's a certain amount of mystery still about what da Vinci was aiming for in these pictures. Clearly, these are male forms in motion. But what precisely they're doing has remained a mystery for several hundred years since they were drawn in Florence. But I'm pleased to say, having reached Gold Coast, that a small amount of investigation has proven that what they're actually doing is looking for the perfect surfboard pose. Da Vinci in Florence was experimenting to find the perfect caddy, which I'm told is the term, and a rio as well, which is the surfing terms which found their origins in ancient Florence but have come to full expression in the Gold Coast. So the collisions have been with us for some time. In more recent times, I think it's still the case, and I don't know, Stella, whether you feel the same, whenever you're interviewed in the media about science and art, it's kind of some extraordinary surprise, right, that the scientists and the artists have found themselves together. It's as if it was something completely new each time, and that novelty is both charming and ignorant, I think. It is not the case that it's new. The year of my birth, 1968, saw an exhibition at the Institute of Contemporary Art called Cybernetic Serendipity. And this was an exhibition which took the creative power of computer science and of automatic generation of form and put it in an art space. The Institute of Contemporary Art has the word art in the title, it's an art space. But the exhibition asserted that technical domains, as one might say, computer science, mathematics, were capable of generating beauty, if not appreciating it, at least generating it. And indeed it was at the ICA that my own career in the counterparts between art and science began. I was the world's first scientist in residence at an arts institution. And I think what I want to talk to you about today is the mechanisms and the formats by which one can engineer the kind of creative collisions that are required in this domain. So the first thing we did was to take a scientist, that was me, it wasn't my idea, and put me into an art space. And as you can imagine, I spent most of my time in the bar, right, with my mates, because that's what you do when you're given license. And the ICA bar in 2002, 3, 4, 5, and I think you'll agree with this, was the place where art and science collide. And so a good bar with a welcoming environment and a place where everybody can feel at home no matter what their origins is essential for the kinds of collisions that we're talking about. And the ICA bar is a place where different people meet. This is a picture from the preview to that exhibition, and it shows Princess Margaret meeting a man in trainers. And while that might not look particularly surprising to those of us who are now acclimatized to the Gold Coast, in London the idea that royalty would meet someone wearing trainers was still a shocking idea in 1968. And so the creative collisions are social as well as technical. And I want to come back to that point at the end, because I think that the kinds of conjunctions that we're interested in can do a lot to disrupt social structures as well. Now, I'm a neuroscientist, and so a lot of the art science collisions that I've been involved with have been about perceiving the world. How do we see what's out there? How do our brains process information? And how can we relate the neurobiological process of seeing to the artistic one? And I just want to acknowledge that the traditions of investigation of how seeing works go back a long time. One might think of Descartes, one might think of Newton and his optics, but actually it goes much further than that. Ibn al-Haytham was the first person to really think about optics. He and his contemporaries defined the refractive index, and yet it's the case when I visit the Gulf and Arab countries that even people who live in Arab countries today would date that back to Newton, who came to these discoveries 700 years after Ibn al-Haytham himself had discovered it. And Haytham asked the following question: is seeing a process that goes into the eyes or one that comes out of the eyes? Okay. Now, that may seem like a silly question. I'm going to try and persuade you that it isn't. But the reason why it was a question was because there were plenty of prevalent thoughts then and through into the Renaissance and beyond that seeing was an active process, that seeing rays came out of your eyes, that they felt the world as your fingers might, they gathered sense impressions of the world, and that your visual investigation of the world was driven out from your eyes. Now, clearly from the point of view of physics, we all know that that's not true. It's photons that come into your eyes, and then the information is processed from there up into the brain. And Haytham made that argument. He said, if I look at the sun directly, it will hurt my eyes. Clearly something is coming from the sun into my eyes, not the other way around. And so the information, the photons, are impinging upon your retina. But modern neuroscience shows that that is not the whole story. Because although it's the case that the photons are going in, if you look at the neurobiology, which is to say look at the connections in your brain, there is a hierarchy, right? There are some low-level areas of your brain that are connecting dots into lines, making lines into shapes, putting shapes into scenes, making scenes into scenarios, taking scenarios into narratives, and so on up. And that's a kind of hierarchy. And clearly the retina, the light-gathering device at the back of your eye, is at the bottom of that hierarchy. But it's a principle of neurobiology, and I hope you're going to be alive to the metaphorical richness of what I'm saying, also in terms of how we build structures, that there are as many connections between the upper areas and the lower areas as there are between the lower areas and the upper areas. It's a principle of neuroscience that if two cortical areas are connected, there are as many connections going one way as the other. These processes have to be two-way if they're real, and we can learn from a neurobiological reference to that effect. But it's also the case in terms of how we see that our seeing is a projection into the world. Our prejudices and our expectations shape the world that we see. Those of you from Gold Coast see the waves differently than I do. When you see a wave breaking, you understand the forces of it. You know that it would be time to get onto the board and get out there, time to have another coffee. You can read the waves, you can see them. It's the same photons hitting our eyes, but you see differently because of your knowledge and expectation. And I can't resist sharing with you, early in my talk, one of the most important findings in visual neuroscience of the last 12 months. This was one which some of you may have encountered through the wonders of the interweb, the blue and black dress versus the gold and white dress. So if you think that the dress is blue and black, please put your hand up. Okay? If you see, looking at this, a white and gold dress, put your hand up. Yeah, ooh. Now, the question is, what on earth is going on here? How can this be? Okay, because you're clearly the same photons are reaching your eyes, right? And incidentally, the genuine disagreement on this, I mean, when you realize that the person sitting next to you really sees it as white and gold, I find it quite an unsettling moment. I mean, it's as if aliens had inhabited... They look like us, they talk like us, but they don't see like us. Very strange. So let me explain briefly the illusion, but contextualize it first. What I want to tell you about this, my friends, is that this is a genuine story, right? There was a shop in Scotland that sold a dress. There was a woman taking a picture of the dress. She was planning to wear it for a wedding. She put it on her social media feed and said, "What do you think of this blue and black dress?" And her friends came back and said, "You mean the white and gold one?" And she was like, "What?" And that is genuinely what happened. It was one of the most tweeted memes of the early part of this year. But what I want to tell you is that this is a genuinely new finding in visual neuroscience, okay? So we knew of the existence of these kinds of objects, but no one had ever constructed one, okay, before, which is kind of weird. And secondly, not only, and I'll tell you how it works in a second, not only is it novel, but it's also irreproducible, which is to say that nobody has succeeded to make another one of these. And when I say nobody, I mean the best visual neuroscientists in the world. We don't understand this. So what am I trying to tell you? That the information flows are not as you might expect. The information does come from the internet. I mean, it is mostly pictures of cats, but occasionally some real stuff filters through, and genuine findings about the world can arise. What's actually going on here in brief is the following. There is a thing called color constancy, and what color constancy allows you to do is to see colors accurately no matter what the illuminating light is. Right? So this suit that I'm wearing is kind of bluey, and in this sort of slightly whitish light, this whitish yellow light indoors, it looks blue. If we were to go outside into the bright sunshine, you will find that the suit will be reflecting much more white light from the sun, but you will still see it as blue because you will make a correction in your brain for the illuminating light, and you will extrapolate from that back to the genuine color of the object. This color constancy effect is very helpful for fashion designers because it enables them to be confident people see their clothes in the same light in different situations. And its origins, speculatively, but probably are to do with when, as primates, we were searching for colored berries in the forest. We became very good at eating a wide range of foods, but it was quite important that we could spot the poisonous ones also at dusk. So even when there was sunset and the forest was illuminated by reddish light, we needed to be able to accurately see the color of the berries that we might or might not want to eat, that might feed us or poison us. And so this color constancy effect was solved. Now, what's going on is the following. Those of you that see the dress as blue and black, and of course you are right, are hypothesizing that this light is being illuminated by white light, because under white light it would look that color. Okay? Those of you that see it as gold and black are hypothesizing, you don't know this consciously, that it is being lit by somewhat bluish light. And if it's being lit by somewhat bluish light, the blue comes from the illumination, not the dress. Your brain automatically corrects for that, and you see the underlying color as being gold. So this strange phenomenon of color correction is a perfect example of our projecting meaning out onto the world. Seeing, my friends, is not a passive thing, it's an active thing. And our prejudices and our expectations, through the very connections of our brain, make their way out into the world and shape the reality that we see. And that's what I just said, you could take to be a statement about the neurobiology, but you can also take it to be about perception and prejudice and how we might make progress by constructing structures with people who might otherwise speak different languages than we do. So now let me tell you a pair of stories about dance, which I came to through my interest in neurobiology and seeing, but which led me through them into an understanding of the kind of structures we need to build to exploit the relationships between art and science in order to do social transformation. Shall I say that again? The structures that we need to build in order to exploit the relationships between science and art in the service of social transformation. So how did I come to be engaged with dancers? I've told you about the color stuff. I've told you about how what we know about color, probably dating back to our primate ancestors, shapes how we see the world. But I became interested in movement as well. We were interested in how you see movement. So this is what's called the biological perception of biological motion. And we became interested in how your own ability to move helps you to see the movements of others. Because I was aware that when I saw dance, I saw it differently than how dancers saw it. That fact of my not being able to dance changes how I see the movement. But we wondered what the underlying neurobiology of that was. And to do that, we did some experiments involving ballet dancers and capoeira dancers. We took ballet dancers from the Royal Ballet and we took capoeiristas. Capoeira is a Brazilian martial art or dance form. The reason for the ambiguity is that it was developed by slaves who weren't allowed to organize into fighting forces, and so they called what they were learning a dance so that the slave owners wouldn't be upset by it. And interestingly, with capoeira, you're not allowed to touch the ground with anything but your feet, your hands and your head. That's because they were wearing uniforms, which if they got scuffed or dirty, they'd be in trouble. So there's no elbows and knees or arses on the floor in capoeira. It's all feet, hands and heads. Capoeira is a fighting form, and it shares with ballet the following property, that you can have a phrase, in this case in Brazilian, and if you say that phrase, a capoeirista will reliably do a certain move. And the same with ballet. You have a phrase in French, which if you read it out, a dancer classically trained will do the same move. And so what we did was we made some kinematically equivalent movements. So what we had was these sequences of movements in these two distinct kinematic forms. We took dancers from both styles and put them in the brain scanner. It's an MRI machine and it looks at blood flow within the brain. What it allows us to do is to tell which bits of the brain are more active or less active in different conditions. So now what we've got is what's called a 2x2 design. We've got two kinds of dancers, and we've got two kinds of dance forms, and they're watching both in the scanner. And you'll see that for each individual subject, they're either seeing a thing they can do, so that would be a ballet dancer looking at the ballet, or a capoeirista looking at the capoeira, or they're looking at a thing that they can't do. They're either looking at a thing they can do and seeing a thing they can't do. And the question was, which bits of your brain do you use in those two different conditions? Now, why is that interesting? Because when you're in the brain scanner, you're instructed to remain still. Okay, you have to do that because otherwise you get a blurry signal. So these people are not moving. But what we found was that when you're looking at the thing that you can do, the bits of your brain that are ordinarily concerned with the control of motion, your movement cortex, why do we call it that? Because it's the bit that if it's damaged, you can't move, right? It's movement brain. That bit of your brain is more active when you see the thing you can do than when you see the thing you can't do. So even when you are still, even when you are unmoving, you are activating your movement control centers to help you understand what you're seeing. And again, we can go metaphorical with that a little bit. When I see a surfer, I can't surf. I have no idea what she's doing, right? If you are a surfer yourself, you will feel it, okay? The outcomes of that work were some highly cited peer review papers. So these were papers that found themselves in the Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience or Cerebral Cortex as a magazine. And we got to be successful scientists because people who were also doing science wrote about our papers in their scientific studies. We couldn't have done the work without Tom Sapsford, who was the choreographer, and all of the dancers. This is not something we could have done on our own in the lab, partly because they were the experimental subjects, but also because they helped us to understand what was happening in the experiments. They told us what it was like as a ballet dancer to see movement. Interestingly, and you may know this, if you're a ballet dancer, going to the ballet isn't that much fun because you see it as a technical form. Equally, having no knowledge of them, if you go to a Japanese dance form, most of us, we're completely lost and we get nothing out of it. It seems you need the sort of intermediate level of familiarity to really appreciate it. But again, I want to explain what happened in terms of social structures. We paid a choreographer and some dancers to help us do this science. We generated a space where those conversations could happen. We generated a space wherein those conversations could happen, where everybody was equal. Everybody's opinions were allowed. These are people that were coming from different places, but were engaging in the middle. And then we went back into our home domains to produce the results. So the results were in the Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience. And Tom Sapsford went back to his choreographic career, a slightly richer man, perhaps a wiser man, but we had detached at the time of the production. So that's the story of ballet and capoeira and how you actively see the world based on your own experience. And now let me tell you a parallel story, but in the opposite direction. And this is another dance story from a dancer called Wayne McGregor, who also came to see me in 2002 at the ICA. He's the resident choreographer at the Royal Ballet. And he was working on a fabulous work called ataxia, which ataxia is the name of a movement disorder. Wayne works with movement vocabularies. He gets his dancers to move. And how he made this piece was that he and his dancers spent a lot of time in a psychology lab, and they practiced a certain kind of distraction techniques. And in distraction techniques, what happens is that you can... I mean, there are certain things you can do while moving, right? So counting backwards from 100 to 199, 98, 97, 96, I can continue to move. But if you count backwards from 100 in 13s... that disrupts your movement. And he worked with a psychologist to find ways of getting people to move that were disrupted by the exercises they were doing. And what he enabled through this process was for his dancers to lose control of their bodies. the dancers lost control of their bodies in the psychology lab by doing these exercises. And from this, Wayne produced a new movement vocabulary. And using that palette, that set of moves, which had never been done before, he created the piece Ataxia, which went on to premiere at Sadler's Wells. Okay, and I have to say, having seen it, it was extraordinary. The movements that the bodies were doing were like none I'd ever seen. So that by the end, and just for fun, Wayne put in a point where one of the dancers just went like that, and it was as if I was seeing that arm movement for the first time. Now, this piece of dance that he produced was at Sadler's Wells, which is a major dance space within London, and was reviewed by the dance press. Okay, it got a review in The Guardian, people liked it. And in fact, there was no neuroscientific or other product from this collaboration. So to map it out for you again, what Wayne did, he took himself a choreographer and some dancers, he took some psychologists. They spent 3 months in the studio in Cambridge doing all of these experiments, in this shared space where everything was okay, where all the borders were down. I call this, incidentally, the Dionysian frenzy, right? Or if you like, the orgy model of interdisciplinary collaboration. There is a point, if you're doing it right, where you kind of lose a sense of who's doing what to whom, okay? That's kind of essential for these collaborations to be taking place. You need to make those spaces and you need to facilitate them right. Having done that, to dress up and to, you know, and to leave and to go back to their day jobs, and so in a sense this convergent, divergent interdisciplinary collaboration is at the heart of success here. We need spaces where we can work together, but we need to go back to our home spaces in order to define what we do. And so in that sense, the performance at Sadler's Wells and the reviews that they produced there, or the papers that we published to great acclaim in the Journal of Cerebral Cortex or Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience were the outcomes back in conventional domains. And when we say we want to remove interdisciplinary boundaries, we're not saying down with disciplines, right? For myself, we're not saying we are all artists. I mean, with all respect, and it's a term which is used a lot, I don't believe we are all artists, I don't believe we are all scientists. We have different disciplines and different domains, but we do need spaces where we can work together. And that's the essence of interdisciplinarity, which all of our work has shown. So now, how are we building that in Science Gallery London? Let me tell you about the structure that we're building. And again, I'm telling you this story partly because I'm incredibly proud of it and very excited. And I'm going from Gold Coast to Melbourne, where there will be a science gallery built through the University of Melbourne. And the sort of structures I'm about to tell you seem to be popping up all over the place. There may be one in Bangalore quite soon, maybe one in Singapore. The original one was in Dublin. But let me tell you about Science Gallery London. Science Gallery is a space where art and science collide. It's going to be built at the base of the Shard, some of you know, it's rather a tall building in London, and it's aimed at 15 to 25-year-olds, which is an interesting demographic. We said on the radio yesterday, they can't be told, the 15 to 25-year-olds. I mean, they sort of know it all already. But they are very interested in their own identities. The process of self-definition as a 15 to 25-year-old, of whether you're the same as the people around you or others, whether you're the same as what you were a year ago or not, is very important. And that's why it's an exciting group to work with. There's no permanent collection at Science Gallery. Everything is driven through seasons of activity. And I'll show you a couple of things from a season we did before the building opened. So we're opening in 2017, but we're running these pre-opening seasons. The season was called Frequencies. And what happens with the season at Science Gallery is that the engagement begins 6 months to a year before the work is shown. So for the 6 months to a year before, we spoke to local young people, to scientists, to artists, to workers of various kinds, to researchers, and we asked them what the rhythms of their life were like. It was a season about how sounds can capture the rhythms of your life. It's not that it's community art, right? There is an open call for proposals, but what's produced is professionally commissioned. But the agenda for what's shown, the curatorial agenda, is driven by the audience. You go out honestly in the 6 months to a year before you do the work, and you say, what do frequencies mean to you in your life? And from that process, you then curate a bunch of scientific exhibits and demonstrations and visualizations, but also performance, visual art, sculpture, and those are woven into a season of activity of about 3 months' duration. So what we have here is a bearded fella from the Sorchestra Ensemble. They play saws like you would play a stringed instrument. So it's a bow that you'd use to play a cello, but you play a saw as well. And a student midwife from St. Thomas's Hospital. And they were exploring the rhythms of birth and making music for a saw from it. And the performance that gave rise to, we showed at the opening of Frequencies, but that resulted in some fabulous sounds. And these were performed in a space next to the hospital. So we invited other midwives, patients, local residents in, to hear the music that was generated from the rhythms of, I'm pleased to say not the actual sort of screams and cursing, but the rhythms of birth. And the other one I want to tell you about briefly is with the fabulous artist Bishi. She's of Bengali origin and had her own sleep waves digitized in a sleep lab. It's a pediatric neurophysiology lab. That's a lab that studies the sleep patterns of children. And she had a disrupted night deliberately and then went to sleep the next morning in the sleep lab. And her own sleep waves were digitized. By the way, can I tell you in terms of the results of art-science collaboration, the guy who runs the lab loves these collaborations because when you're running a lab like this, you need volunteers and subjects. You need them to come in. And also you need them to come back. Right, so you record them once, but you need to do a follow-up 3 months later and 6 months later. And he finds that by collaborating with artists and putting his work out there, it's easier for him to recruit subjects, and the data he gets from them is better, and they come back for the follow-up visits because they're engaged with the project. So back in the pediatric neurophysiology lab, he's delighted by the collaboration. And what Bishi came up with was a setting of Shakespeare's Sonnet 43, which is all about sleep, where the music was generated from her own sleep patterns. And she performed this in Guy's Chapel, the chapel of the hospital, with some beautiful images from Susan Aldworth in the background. This was a concert that we sold out for two sittings, 250 seats each, without any significant publicity. Because she has a following of her own, Bishi is the Eric Clapton of the sitar. And so this collaboration resulted in a piece of incredibly high-quality music, art, high quality in its own terms, reviewed by the music critics. And what do I know? I'm just a neuroscientist. But the curators and the audience loved it in its own terms, but driven from world-leading science as well. And so from this process of collaboration and workshopping, we produced these high-quality products. Let me say one other thing before I finish about how we do this. We're into social justice and we're into empowerment, and what I mean by that is that by the kind of loosening of interdisciplinary boundaries that Science Gallery and art science projects themselves produce, this opens up a space where non-experts can speak. Okay? The loosening of these boundaries opens up a space where non-experts can speak. So here is another one of the workshops we did about things called earworms. Earworms are songs that get into your head and that you can't get rid of, you know, when you've got a track in your tune. It's a direct translation from the German, the earworm. And they were investigating and, in fact, composing their own earworms. You'll hear one of them in a second. But by having a workshop on this genuine topic of neuroscientific interest, but that was driven by a bunch of local young people whose input into it was genuinely of interest to the neuroscientists, the participation that they had in the space was not just turning up to a lecture and being told about the structure of their brains, but actively contributing to research. Okay? So their involvement in this project was as participants, as shapers of the research and of subjects, and they were seeing it in their own terms. And the final trick that we played, which I think is clever. It's a very powerful technique, and this was called the media team. So everything we do in Science Gallery is covered by a group of 15 to 25-year-olds who are early-stage bloggers, video makers, YouTubers, and have their own early-stage professional practice. And the clever thing that we did was to hand over control of the documentation of the season to that group. So the media team are the official documenters. This is not the youth project, my friends. This is the project. They are the official documenters of the process. And by letting them take control of the discourse, we're making a very strong statement, which is that the power is with the audience, and they're setting the agenda. And I commend to you the model of empowering the people that you want to work with here in Gold Coast and beyond, to let them set the agenda and to let them help you generate the space where these kinds of collisions can take place. And if you do that, then the expertise that happens at the heart of these collaborations will gain in power for itself, and allow itself to be held by the audience. I'll tell you why the title is Charlie Chaplin and Albert Einstein Meet in a Bar. The joke is that they met at the premiere of City Lights, is the film, and the crowd went wild. They were both very famous men by this point. And Chaplin says to Einstein, "You know, they're applauding me because they understand everything I do, and they're applauding you because they understand nothing that you do." Right? And that tension between knowledge and ignorance, right, is at the heart of everything we do. If we're going to genuinely collaborate, we have to listen to the people who know nothing about what we do, and we have to listen to the people who know everything, who are the experts, and we have to find spaces where both of their voices can be heard. Thank you very much for your attention.
Neuroscientist Dr. Daniel Glaser speaking at the 2970 Degrees Art Innovation Conference on the Gold Coast. That's it for Big Ideas for tonight. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
In the Bodysphere podcast,
Der Führer und Reichskanzler Adolf Hitler,
how a man who hated sport held the greatest games the world had ever seen.
There were these great banners everywhere, swastikas everywhere.
Berlin, 1936.
It was a grandiose sort of an affair.
It wasn't an Olympic Games for the benefit of sport and mankind. It was a charade.
Power, propaganda and perfect bodies. The Bodysphere. Listen online at the RN website.